Okay, our last speaker before lunch break is Rich Townsend, and he will talk to us about the open source tools for exploring the E-Star evolution and oscillation.
Okay, so my talk today is really less about science and more about advertising. A couple of codes that may prove quite useful for studying BE-star oscillations. One of the codes, Gyre, is an oscillation code that I've been working on for the last few years. And the other code that you may have heard of is the Mesostellar Evolution Code, which is an open source code that's been developed primarily by Bill Paxton at UC Santa Barbara, but with inputs from many other people. So let me tell you about Mesa first. The reason why I'm talking about these codes together is that they kind of work hand in hand, but Mesa is definitely the sort of the heavyweight of the two. Mesa stands for Modules for Experiments in Stellar Astrophysics. It's a suite of modules that handle everything from numerics, hydro solvers, matrix solvers, microphysics solvers that will calculate equations of state, opacity, nuclear generation rates, and then also macrophysics routines, prescriptions for convection, for transport of angular momentum by diffusion, by turbulence, things like that. So MESA is this set of modules, but it's also a 1D stellar evolution code, or a quasi-1D code, because it can handle some degree of departure from sphericity using a parametric approach. MESA is written in modern Fortran, So it looks very different from the Fortran that our grandfathers used to use, that Stan maybe once used with his with his punch cards. The guy who has done most of the development work on Mesa, Bill Paxton, actually comes from a software engineering background. He's not originally an astronomer. So Bill is actually to blame for PostScript. He was one of the people who developed PostScript at Adobe Systems. He retired. He went to live in a retirement village in Arizona. And after 10 years, he got bored. And he decided to go back to school, and he learned astronomy. And while he was learning astronomy as an undergraduate at UC Santa Barbara, Lars Bilster noticed him and said, "This guy's obviously quite smart and quite highly motivated. I'm going to get him to write code for me." So basically, Lars chained Bill in a basement for a few years, and at the end of it, Bill produced Mesa. Now, some of the development of Mesa has been offloaded to other people, but Bill is still the lead developer, and I've never met anybody quite like him, just in terms of his productivity and his creativity, and also someone who can write code that's quite as carefully crafted and yet high performance as Bill. So Mesa's written in a modern dialect of Fortran, a mixture of 95 and 2003. It's open source, so everybody can grab a copy of it. And the philosophy behind Mesa is not just about being open source, it's about being open science. Every single paper that's published using models for Mesa, the authors are encouraged to make available all of their input files and the tweaks they made to Mesa to get the results they did. So it's really trying to change the way we do science. Rather than hoarding software as a sort of proprietary in-group thing and jealously guarding its secrets, we're trying to make all the secrets within Mesa known. Now, this is a double-edged sword, because everybody gets to see all the warts in Mesa, whereas with closed codes, the warts are kind of hidden away. So it kind of means you're batting from on an unlevel playing field. But on the flip side, it means that there's a real high level of community engagement in Mesa. And if something doesn't seem to be right, people are interested in fixing it quickly. So the code is extensively documented, and as part of the documentation, many test case examples are provided. So when you download and install Mesa, it comes with test cases that, for instance, will take a solar mass model from pre-main sequence contraction all the way to white dwarf crystallization just in a single run. There are models, massive star models, that will run you from pre-main sequence all the way up to supernova collapse through all of the burning stages. So that's pretty impressive. So as I mentioned, there's a big community around Mesa. This is a map of Mesa users worldwide. It seems we've only got one user in Canada. I think that's a terrible pity, so try harder, Canada. I mean, look, there are people in Mongolia using Mesa. So... Right now in Santa Barbara, there are about 40 people involved in the third annual Mazer Summer School, where people spend a week working with Mazer, learning how to do various tasks, and coming up with ideas for improving the code. Obviously, it's too late to go this year, but next year there'll be another call for participants in the summer school. I invite you all to go. It's a lot of fun. Santa Barbara is not a bad place to visit. So in April 2014, we had around 770 registered users. So in terms of its impact on the Stellar Evolution community, Mazer really is without parallel. It's changing the way we do Stellar Evolution. The papers actually discussing the code, there are a pair of them, and what we call the instrument papers. The first one came out in 2011, and then more recently last year, the second instrument paper came out announcing lots of new features in Mazer. And what's really interesting about these new features is there are three things that, as BE star fanatics, we're all interested in: oscillations, rotation, and of course massive stars. And so this new release of Mazer has got a lot of functionality that's potentially useful if we want to construct evolutionary models of massive stars. So let me just talk a bit about how rotation is done in Mazer, because that's kind of the most important aspect of these new features. The treatment of rotation assumes a cellular angular velocity profile, and this is following the paradigm put forward by Jean-Paul Zahn in 92, that strong horizontal turbulence mixes quantities across isobars. Then the actual transport of angular momentum from one shell to the next is treated diffusively. So this is the same as in the Kepler and Stern code. So that's Alex Hager's code and Norbert Langer's code. But it's different than how the Geneva code does it and how the newer Rose code does it. So Andre Madeira has drummed into us for the last 15 years that you cannot treat angular momentum transport diffusively. You've got to put some advection in there. And to some extent, he's right. He's got a point. But a problem we face at the moment is between these two approaches, we're not altogether sure which one is necessarily correct, especially when we're at the most rapid rotation limits. There are certain lines of observational evidence, I know Rivi will go into this in greater detail, that suggests that our picture of rotation in very rapidly rotating stars is still incomplete. When that picture does become complete, someone will send an email to Bill Paxton, and a day and a half later he will have implemented it in Mazer. So Mazer's kind of agnostic about the science that goes into it. It just wants to put in the best possible science. And I asked Bill, I said, Bill, why haven't you done advective transport of angular momentum? Isn't that the right way to do it? And he says, I think the jury's still out on that. I'm not sure. So I'm just waiting for the chips to fall where they may, and then I'll put it in. So this is an example of Mazer in action, modeling angular momentum angular momentum evolution in a rotating 15 solar mass star. And these two plots show the angular momentum profile, a specific angular momentum profile, as a function of enclosed mass at various different stages of the star's evolution. So the zero age main sequence is the black line, and then there's a sort of orange line, which is, I guess, the TAMS. And then this goes all the way through from the main sequence lifetime to the point where the star's infall velocity exceeds the speed of sound, and we know that it's going to be a core collapse supernova. So Mazer can get through all of these different stages and track the angular momentum profile as it goes along. These two panels, the difference between them is in this one, there's a magnetic field generated by the Taylor-Sprout dynamo. And as you can see, comparing the TAMS profile here to the one here, with a magnetic field, we tend to spin down the core and spin up the envelope. So that's all pretty standard. So one of the other features introduced in Mazer in the recent release was the so-called ASTRO module, which is really designed to do astroseismology on the fly. Mazer's ASTRO module provides a tight coupling to two pulsation codes, the Adapulse code by Jan Christiansen Dalsgaard, which is kind of the sort of gold standard adiabatic pulsation code, and my newer Jaya code. And what I mean by tight coupling is that rather than having to write a model to disk at some point in following a star's evolution and then read that into the pulsation code and calculate an oscillation spectrum from it, this is all done internally. So within Mazer, at each time step, we can go down the economy option road. We can calculate an oscillation spectrum for the current stellar model and maybe store that to disk. But there's also a deluxe option in the ASTRO module, which allows us to automatically adjust the stellar parameters to best match a set of observed frequencies. And when I say automatically adjust, what we do is we take the frequencies predicted by a model, we compare them against the observations, come up with some sort of chi-squared statistic to test the fit. And if the fit's not that good, then we change various input parameters, such as the initial mass, the mixing length parameter, the degree of overshoot, and we rerun the model. And this is all done automatically. So when you give your set of frequencies and a set of search parameters, you can then go away for a few hours and come back, and MESA will have converged in on the best fitting model to that set of oscillation frequencies. And so this is an example of MESA in action doing an optimization for the mass on this axis and the mixing length parameter on this axis for HD4, blah, blah, blah. And this is actually a lowish mass subgiant star, but it's one that appeared in the instrument paper. And this is using Gaia to calculate oscillation frequencies. And each of these circles represents a step in the optimization process as the codes feel around parameter space till they find where the chi-squared has a local minimum representing the best possible match to the observed oscillation frequencies. Okay, so I got 5 minutes left, or 4 minutes, to talk about Gaia, so I'm going to take it up a little bit, okay? So Gaia is not an acronym, it doesn't stand for anything, but it is pronounced with a soft G, so please, Ravi, stop calling it Gaia. Gaia is a sort of circulation in the ocean or in weather patterns. The code was originally written to provide a new way to model pulsation and rotation. It uses a novel numerical scheme that my erstwhile postdoc Seth Teitler and I came up with called Magnus Multiple Shooting. And this is a very flexible approach to solving two-point boundary value problems, of which the oscillation equations are an instance. It's very robust, it's efficient, and it's extremely accurate. It also can be easily parallelized using both shared memory directives, OpenMP, and spread across a cluster using MPI. It's written in modern Fortran, an incredibly transparent source code. It's open source, just like MESA, and there's extensive documentation consisting of a wiki, inline comments, a user forum. This is an example of Gaia in action showing quite how accurate it can be. This is the error in calculating the frequencies of the homogeneous compressible sphere. So that's an N equals zero polytrope. And as we increase the number of points, the error in between the calculated frequencies and what the frequency should be, which is known analytically, drops off. And for the highest order Magnus solver, which we call GL6, that's a sixth order solver, with just 1,000 grid points, we can get frequencies that agree with the analytical values to within 1 part in 10 to the 14. And so doing tests of MESA compared to Adapulse, the gold standard adiabatic code, we've managed to get frequencies in agreement down to picohertz. And this is important with when we have satellites like Kepler, who really can push the observational uncertainties in oscillation frequencies down to at least the nanohertz level. Picohertz, yeah, maybe we're not quite there with the observations yet. But this is an illustration of Gaia's non-adiabatic capabilities in action. This is an instability strip for Beta Cephei stars calculated by Peter de Grote. As part of last year's MESA summer school, he got all participants to calculate this instability strip. And this basically shows a set of evolutionary tracks in red on the main sequence, and the sort of green regions are those models which are unstable to the iron bump Kappa mechanism instability and therefore show low-order P modes. This is another example of Gaia in action, again with MESA, for modeling the oscillation spectrum of KIC, that's Kepler input catalog, blah-de-de-blah. So this is a star observed by Kepler. This is actually a slowly pulsating B star. And the authors, this is Papik et al., just came out, found the star shows 19 dipole modes with approximately equal period spacing, and all of the dipole modes are split into rotationally split. And the degree of rotational splitting varies from one mode to the other, giving us some really solid constraints on the internal rotation profile of the star. So although historically we haven't really been able to do much astroseismology with massive stars, we're really reaching that point now. Admittedly, this is a slowly rotating star, but you know, the future holds possibly far more interesting things when K2 starts observing rapidly rotating massive stars. I was hoping to have time to say something about rotation and different approaches, but putting rotation and pulsation together is complicated. There are a lot of different ways to skin the cat. You can ask me a question about this if you want at the end, since I've got 10 seconds. This is JAR in action using spectral expansion, the best way to do rotation. This is the roadmap for JAR. I'm going to be working on putting rotation in a bit more. This is a graphic from a collaboration I'm involved in called the Spider Network, which is aiming to get better constraints on the rotation, rotational evolution of massive stars. And this is the summary. And there are some links here that you can write down that will take you to the sites for Mazer, JAR, and the Mazer software development kit, which is a set of compilers and libraries that make it easy to install Mazer. Thank you. Sure. Oh, okay. You want to talk about rotation? Sure.
No, the question is basically, we have beautiful data sets now with dozens of periods, and what you're telling us, we're still not at a position to analyze them in seismology.
The problem we really face is for extreme rotation, I mean, it's ultimately this last line. There are not models for stellar structure and evolution that can adequately reproduce very rapidly rotating stars. And without those input models, being able to do a meaningful pulsation analysis is quite limited. It really shuts down the scope of any pulsation analysis. So even though quasi-1D stellar models can go up to rapid rotation rates, there's still a lot of approximations involved. And even 2D stellar structure models are very much 2D static models. They're not evolutionary models. They're not actually following the proper transport of angular momentum and elements throughout the star's evolution. So I would, for the moment, take results from the most rapidly rotating stars, pulsation analyses, with some degree of a pinch of salt. I see you're all busy typing in the URL, so.
Let's thank Rich one more time. Thank you. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank all speakers this morning, especially.